Please be sure to visit our Etsy store for some great Warrior Next Door podcast merchandise, and please consider becoming a premium subscriber. Just go to our Facebook page to sign up and receive each series uncut in its entirety.
Welcome back, Warrior Next Door listeners, to the second installment of the Steve Bickler series. Steve served with Aziz in Iraq during the waning days of the American occupation, and he provides a really interesting perspective to the podcast series that we featured with Aziz back in January. This is Steve's perspective from the American side, who served along with Aziz, and in this series you're going to hear, or in this episode I should say, you're going to hear about more about the MITS team and how he finally ended up meeting and serving with Aziz. So listen in.
On my birthday, 2010, I'm flying to Fort Polk, Louisiana. If there's anything to know about Fort Polk, Louisiana in the wintertime, it is probably the exact opposite of Iraq in the summertime, which is where I was headed.
Yeah.
So fall of 2010, it's all combat training, right? So basically they took a bunch of support weenies, right? Personnelists, comm systems guys like me, logistics guys. We had some military police, Air Force version of military police, and it's all Air Force and Navy. And they drop us on an Army base and had a bunch of infantry sergeants who apparently thought that it was basic training again, or that they had, you know, whatever axe they had to grind with the Air Force, or not joining the Air Force when they were 18, they were going to take it out on a bunch of, now I'm a major at this point, a bunch of field grade officers and NCOs, senior NCOs for the Air Force. We were salty. We did not like them. They did not like us. We have been at this for a while. We're like, tell me the stuff I need to know. That being said, right, it's culture shock world, right? So we're in, you know, Aziz, right, has had an amazing journey where he became an interpreter for the Americans from his time there. When we were in Fort Polk, Louisiana, we ran into an entire Army career field called Nine Limas. These were native Arab speakers from all of these countries, or from Arab communities in the United States, that were joining the Army, some of them to get citizenship, but were joining to be interpreters in that regard. So I thought I was going to get a military interpreter, right? Because that's what I learned in training. So we would grab the interpreter. So we'd get an interpreter who knew Arabic. We would have us, and they would train us on how to talk to the Iraqis. So we have these interactions with former Iraqi Army, like think the old Baathist folks that, you know, we kicked out in 2003. There was a bunch of them living outside of Fort Polk, Louisiana, to do exactly all of this kind of role playing, to teach these support guys like me how to be advisors to the Iraqis, right? So, I mean, they had all the crazy stuff, like throwing shoes at us and stuff, you know, trying to teach us Arabic, right? So we had Arabic speakers trying to teach us Arabic. I got a little bit, like, it's still like going, you know, trying to speak Spanish at the resort in Mexico more than anything else at this point when you're in Fort Polk. He's like, I'm trying to learn this language, but I'm not really immersed in it. And oh, by the way, the 3 hours, you know, a day that I'm getting of Arabic culture and being, you know, Iraqi culture and being an advisor and all that interaction is coupled with go to the range and shoot all the guns that you've only shot a couple of times in your career. You know, go through all of the combat stuff, right? So, you know, they'd load us with misfiring weapons. We had to learn the 50 cal. We had to learn the grenade launcher. All of those things fun, by the way. Story. Again, right? Because we didn't like the NCOs that were teaching us and they didn't like us, right? They put me on the 50 cal for familiarization because I wasn't going to be a gunner. They decided at that point in training, I wasn't going to be a gunner. I was going to drive, right? So I was going to drive. So I was driving Humvees and MRAPs around. And but they still wanted us on the 50 cal because anybody could have to go on the 50 cal at any time because somebody gets shot, pull them down. Somebody has to go up and man the gun. So they gave us what was called familiarization fire. So we get like 200 rounds. And I get up there and I do my 200 rounds, whatever. And, you know, this really cocky Army NCO comes by and he goes, "Sir, what'd you think?" And I was like, "It was great, Sergeant. It was just like sex. It was awesome. I felt like a god, and it didn't last very long." And I walked off.
So I just had to put that in there, dude. I mean, that was his way of letting the NCO know, fine, I can play that game too. I could act like the recruit if you want me to be the recruit. But pretty intense training. The thing I didn't really appreciate were the nine Limas that we had a bunch of basically American interpreters who spoke Arabic. And you're going to hear more about those later when he talks about being deployed, about how important those people were. But anyway,
by the way, but one of the things he mentioned was that some of the people were doing it to get citizenship.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, well, that's cool. I mean, I'm all for that. You know, you want to help out our military, then by golly, yeah, I think you should get a benefit from that. And that would be citizenship at a minimum.
And think about this. So, for people who listen to the Aziz series, you know that he had to spend 2 years in Iraq, almost getting killed, before his green card came through. After all that work he did as an interpreter, you have people from other countries who speak Arabic who are volunteering to be interpreters, who are going to be able to get their citizenship because they're here. Yeah. And yet Aziz was not able to get that same level of consideration in country, in Iraq, where he had far more skin in the game.
Right.
Unbelievable. So, okay. So we talked about the guns a little bit. The next clip with training was something I did not know. I asked him a question about culture, and here it is.
What was the biggest disconnect or the biggest culture shock thing you learned about having to be an American in Iraq that most people wouldn't appreciate, that you were like, holy crap, that's a really bad thing that an American could do over there?
There wasn't a big one for me. The biggest thing that I learned was don't say no.
Oh, really?
Hopefully don't say no.
Huh.
Because and I learned this when we got to Basra, to the Bayak as well, was don't say no, and don't say inshallah. Right. So no means it is never going to happen. Maybe means it's still going to happen. And that the culture in Iraq is very much, you don't give definitive no's. Definitive no's, I don't need to talk to you anymore. So if I tell you no, Tony, right? If I tell you no, then like we're done. There's nothing, I got nothing to talk to you about. Why should I even advise you? Or why should I even humor myself of talking to you as my advisor? Because you're not going to give me what I want.
Oh, be damned.
So everything was maybe, or let me think about it, or let me see what I can do, or let me go back to my bosses and see it, right? Because that's how they did us too, right? It's like, I never got a yes.
Yeah.
Never really got a yes. So it was learned. That was the big lesson in training that I learned. It's like, okay, I can't say no.
I'll be damned. Because you're right. Here in the United States, no, it just simply means, well, for now, we may not consider that, but there's been so many things that people say no to that eventually, I mean, you know, we can sway around that more, but what you're saying is over there, that's it. That's the death
that was
of that.
It. Especially with Americans, right? Because, and it was more of an American thing than anything else, right? It's like, really? If I was bargaining with you in a market, we can say no, we can walk away, we can do all that stuff, right? It's like, you know, conquerors in the Middle East, when they have said no, like, oh, we're done here. We're done talking about it. There's no value you can give me if you say no.
I'll be.
So that was my big takeaway from training.
Yeah.
Was that. And just knowing that, like, and then look, I was communicating with the guy who was there before me. And I was like, well, what's the one thing I can't do? He's like, don't say no.
No kidding.
And that'll get into how sort of advising went, but like you just went into this whole dance of back and forth of like, maybe, and you just get closer to a yes, but you never really get to yes, but you never are at no either. So it was a really weird, way of thinking about war, right? Because I'm like, I didn't think I was going to be in a sales negotiation, you know?
Yeah.
So this reminds me of that highly esteemed, and I think it may have won an Academy Award movie, Dumb and Dumber, where Lloyd is asking out the really hot, you know, rich girl who's been, you know, being blackmailed. And he's saying, what do you think the chances are of a guy like you and a girl like me, and he does get it backwards in the dialogue, getting together? And she says, I don't think that's going to happen. And he's saying, so that you're saying that there's a chance.
Right.
It's not a hard no. It's not a hard no.
Dude, it is so much in American culture to use no as a negotiating tactic to make people think, oh crap.
But we started with our kids, when they're babies, when there's a little
yes.
Right. Yeah. You'll say no, because you're trying to teach them a hard black and white lesson.
Yeah. And the thing is it reminds me of when I go to visit you in the Green Barn and we meet and you say, hey man, let's do shots. And I say, no, we're not doing shots. And then an hour later, we're doing shots. So no doesn't mean no in America, because there's a perfect example of that right there.
He's talking whiskey shots, not hypodermic needle shots. Okay.
Oh so. Yeah. Like, So anyway,
that rarely happens anymore. We're getting too old for that, Tony.
Oh my gosh. Oh my, whatever. So anyway, so I thought that was really interesting. I hadn't thought about that. And you got to remember, in the Middle East, right, we're talking about millennia of cultures, of conquerors, of being occupied and having to deal with people like Mongols and you know, people, Sargon the Great, right? I mean, there's a very different viewpoint of the relationship between the occupier and the occupiee. Didn't appreciate that. So now, in the next clip, he's going to tell you what his role is.
And so when you went to training for MITS, what was your role? What did they say your job was supposed to be when you got over there?
Keep things stable, get them the resources they need to sustain a conflict themselves. That's where we were at, right? We're moving into 2011. There's starting to be rumors that we're going to pull out.
Yeah.
Not in 2011 like we did, but like there's starting to be those rumors, right? And Iraq was relatively stable, right? So, I mean, there was MITs that were going to Afghanistan and MITs that were going to Iraq, right? MITs that were going to Iraq, we were talking to Iraqis in a trailer, right? In like an office complex, right? Because we were going to headquarters. We were going to go talk at the headquarters. The ones that were going to Afghanistan were still doing Afghanistan stuff. So those MITs were like learning to be village, you know, talk to village elders and stuff like that, right? So that was like, it was even two different tracks within the MIT training. Because it's like, if you're going to Afghanistan, you're going to see some real shit like in the villages. Yeah. You're going to Iraq, you're going to a military headquarters, you're going to be talking to senior level people. That's why we're sending senior, you know, senior field grade officer types into those areas. So it was like, it was a completely different set of even people, even the types of Air Force and Navy people that were in this training with me, because it's like, oh, you're a junior NCO. Let me guess, you're going to Afghanistan, aren't you? Yes, I am. Okay, cool. Like
that. So let's talk about that too. So the people that you're training with, which ultimately go to Iraq, describe where they came from. I mean, were they from all branches of the service? Did you notice any sort of pattern, like, hey, they got a techie here and a grunt here? What was it like?
No, so it was all the support disciplines, right? So it was mostly Air Force. We were about 80% Air Force, about 20% Navy.
Okay.
Actually, even more than that. I think it was like 90-10. And it was, right, so, you know, the joint staff model, and I don't know if anybody's talked about this on your show before, right, is there's J directorates, right? So there's J advisors, right? So J1 is personnel, J2 is intelligence, J3 is operations, 4 is logistics, 5 is plans, 6 is communications, which is what I was, 7 is training, which usually kind of rolls in with 3 in operations, And then eight is finance and nine is civil affairs and medical. Mm-hmm. So that's any military organization, any joint military organization, that's how it's broken down, right? So that's how we taught them too. So if you're going to an Iraqi regional headquarters, like the Basra Area Operations Command, like I did, like you're going to fit in one of those directorates because we made them go into those directorates because that's, we organized them, the new Iraqi army, the way we wanted it to be, which was like us, because that makes the most sense for us. And so think all of those different disciplines is what we had, right? So we had a couple of pilots that were becoming operations advisors because pilots are operations in the Air Force, right? Intel, we had a few Intel field grade officers that were there. We had some communications NCOs. We had some Intel NCOs. Like, it was all of those disciplines, but for the most part, it was techies, personnel folks, medics, a lot of medics. Mm. And then that's kind of how they taught us, right? Is to go from there. One that was unique was I had a roommate in training. He was going to be an operations advisor. So he was going to go give them advice on ground operations, right? So he was going to go to Afghanistan and help them learn how to fight, basically. He was a missileer, Tony.
He'd spent a missileer in a silo?
A silo guy. Was going to go to Afghanistan and teach these guys how to be grunts.
Ooh, so I guess everyone was stretching out a little bit on this deployment.
This is about the time where, you know, everybody's sort of stretching out, right? We're really, look, I'll say it, right? I mean, you probably wanted an army communications guy to advise the Iraqi army on how to do army stuff, not a guy who learned tactical radios in training, who just happened to be working on computers for the last decade. Right.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Just came from the NSA of all places. Right. Granted, I wasn't in those things, but right.
But that was your path, right? Your path wasn't to do communications for the Iraqi military in a transition team.
Yeah.
So was this deliberate? Do you think it was their way of saying, hey, we got a bunch of trained, intelligent, like you said, you know, mid-grade field officers, you know, we're going to treat them like Swiss Army knives? Or was it just like a military kind of weird snafu thing that just happens once in a while?
No, it was a little bit how the Air Force deployed people, right? Because the Air Force, right, the Army deploys as a unit, right? The Army deploys as a unit. And by the way, the Army's fixed this since then, right? They've got these things called Security of Force Assistance Battalions now and brigades.
Oh, okay.
That basically, there's not going to be MIT teams in the future because we got these brigades of people that are just in all of these support disciplines to do this work.
Ah,
Green Berets can't, right? Because that was the thing. It's like we tapped the Green Berets out on direct action, going and shooting guys in the face, which wasn't their primary mission, right? Their primary mission was supposed to be like this kind of foreign internal defense, build up the militaries of foreign countries, right? But they were too busy taking out terrorists, right? So, and we had a two-front war. So how do you go about? You pull from where you have. And the Air Force was an individual deployment model. So Army deploys as a group. Air Force deploys onesie-twosie, right? So, you know, it was rare that three guys would get sent to the same place like my last deployment, where three of us got sent together to Camp Victory. That was super rare. Everybody else was like, you guys know each other? That's awesome. How cool.
Yeah. I'd be willing to bet that unless we have listeners who are in the Air Force, they would not have known that. I didn't know that. I didn't realize that there was a different. Yeah.
For everything except the pilots, right? So if you get a pilot, pilot's going to be like, I don't know what Bickler was talking about. Like,
we
deploy together all the time. Well, yeah, you did because
you're in a squadron, you're training together.
With your bird, right? I'm in a squadron, but it's just a squadron of people.
Yeah.
So like, it's a body pool, right? So they put us where they wanted us, right? So that was, I left on my birthday on November 28th of 2010 and came back to Fort Meade in February. And I had 3 weeks before I left for Iraq, right around, what was it? Yeah, right around the end of March. So okay. 3-4 weeks. And
did you deploy with a team? Did you leave the MITS training with a team, or the teams formed over there in Iraq?
team was forming, team's already there, right? So there's a mid team there, right? There was a crew of Army folks that made the core of the team. And then the Air Force folks came in every 6 months, right? So there's there's already not team continuity per se. I trained with one person, an Intel Lieutenant Colonel. I trained with one person in Fort Polk that ended up with my team.
So what have we learned? We've learned that the people that were pulled in these MITS teams were a diverse group, primarily Air Force and Navy. We learned that their MOS, the thing that they were trained to do in the service, didn't necessarily have anything to do with what they would be doing in a MITS team. We learned that they were deployed piecemeal, that they didn't just train as a team over there and go over in Iraq. They came over as replacements. And we learned that the MITS teams are gone because there's a better solution, those civil affairs battalions, which is what Dale Coyenga, someone who you and I interviewed and featured last year in our podcast, was a big proponent of. So it's a long clip, but there's a lot of stuff in there behind the scenes that I thought was worth capturing.
What was striking me was the way that how our conflicts have changed compared to what we've been used to featuring, which has been the World War II story.
Yeah.
And how during World War II, the front just moved in one line over towards Berlin, and the Soviets came from the other direction, you know, the Russians did. And, you know, rebuilding, you know, there weren't MITS teams back then.
Oh.
You know, I mean, to handle, I mean, he said there were, what, 9 different levels, or like finance and all this other stuff. And was there anything kind of equivalent to that, like the nucleus of that back then? Or did they just, that was when they really realized, probably ought to put something together that handles this sort of like reconstruction, essentially.
It feels to me like this was an ad hoc venture to hasten getting our troops out of Iraq, which is something that
it does feel like that.
It does. Barack Obama was popularly elected on one of the key pillars of his platform was we're going to quote unquote, bring our troops home. And I just feel like this is a response to that. It does not feel like a well-oiled machine to me.
Wouldn't you think though, even given that sort of, you know, command from upon high, you know, to do this, couldn't it be done less ad hocly?
Yeah, I think it could be.
It's the military. You know, we've been fighting this thing for, at that point, 11 years, 10 years. I'm always surprised when it's just like the Afghanistan pullout. I'm always surprised when something completely falls off, the wheels fall off of something. And you're like, how in the world? We've seen this coming.
Yes.
How could this... What's behind this, and how could there be a debacle like this happening? And I'm not saying that the MITS team stuff or what they're doing was a debacle by any stretch.
Right.
But I'm just saying that I just don't understand. Our military has been the strongest, proudest, most successful military, you know, in human history. I just don't understand how these things end up happening.
I know. It's like, it's almost like when you're at work and someone gives you, your boss gives you an arbitrary deadline, and you just rush to get a bunch of crap done, and then you show him or her the stuff, and they're like, "Yeah, okay, thanks." It's like, "Oh, you don't need this now? Oh, no, you know, we'll look at it. Maybe we'll do it, you know, next quarter." It's like, "Oh, because if I had known that I had till next quarter, this whole thing would have went down very differently.
It would look a lot better. It wouldn't be crap.
It certainly would. You wouldn't see the Saigon thing. You wouldn't see the Afghanistan thing."
Right.
And so, in later clips, you're going to hear this part of it come back to haunt us in terms of how we left. How you think this went down is actually worse than I ever realized. So, at any rate, now on this next clip, he's finally going to go into Basra, join the MITS team, and ultimately connect with Aziz.
And so they throw me on this Black Hawk helicopter, and we take off. And about 10 minutes later, we're twisting a little bit, and I drop down in this place. All it is dust and tents and brown. And there's an Army guy there, and he goes, "Hey, I'm Scott. Why were you guys shooting flares off?" And he's like, I was like, "We're shooting flares off?" Like, yeah, you guys were firing flares off. I was like, "Holy shit." No, he must have got shot at. What?
Well, it's like, welcome to Basra, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And you're there to win hearts and minds and advise people and do all this stuff, and you're getting shot at on the way in.
Oh, yeah. On the way in, right? The daily military stuff is just completely different because we are living in tents, like nine-man tents, right? And Aziz talked about this because Aziz lived in a tent a couple tents away from me, right, where he said he stayed on base all that time. You know, his was kind of an open bay 30-man tent where they just got a place and all the interpreters sort of just slept in that tent. We were at least partitioned, so I had my own space, but it was an 8-man tent. Mm. So, you know, I had a chair and I had a bed that somebody left behind and a little desk and a fridge that over time, because somebody allied had been there since 2004. Mm-hmm. So, right, the British had the compound first. So we had all the keep calm and carry on, you know, signs all over our tents and stuff because that's legacy from the British, right?
No, I did not know that.
Oh, yeah, they put that up. They put that shit up everywhere. That isn't just a World War II thing. They put that up everywhere.
That's a thing.
Oh, yeah. If you go to a British compound or anywhere where there's British military, there will be a keep calm and carry on.
I did not know that. So
at least up until 2011, yeah.
Okay. So over time, you guys would accumulate and be able to reuse the stuff that was left behind.
Oh, yeah. Like somebody gets a fridge downtown at some point from an interpreter maybe, right? Mops it off, plugs it in, right? Now, hey, it's there until it breaks, right? Yeah. We had a 55-gallon drum of God knows what that somebody had cut off with a welder and made into a grill that we had acquired at some point over the previous years, right?
So it's kind of like a college dorm when someone leaves their refrigerator behind.
You know, my wife gives me crap all the time about this wooden box that I inherited in college. When I was in college, it was summertime and I was moving to a temporary apartment and I was moving my junk in while this other guy was moving his junk out from another apartment. He's like, "Hey, you want this wooden box?" And I'm like, "Yeah, that's a very nice wooden box. I could put my TV on that. It's fantastic." So I have kept that with me all of these years.
Oh my gosh.
And my wife is so annoyed with me that I have this wooden box. She says she's going to bury me in that box. That's going to be my coffin. And I still have it. I'll show it to you next time you're at the Green Barn. It's up in the loft.
I so want to see that, dude. You know, I think people who love history are kind of sentimental. You know, I think we hold on to things like that. And I think it's cool that you still have that.
It's a very well-made wooden box. I mean, I was very impressed. I thought it was fantastic.
Oh,
it has been very useful. It stores lots of stuff.
Oh, there you go. And now it's upstairs in your loft and it's ready to continue its service to the Fairfield family.
My wife inherited her grandfather's model railroad train set that he had packed away in these cardboard boxes. Now it's stored in that wooden box and protected way better, I might add, than the cardboard box. Anyway, I
look at that. No, it's not a digression. It's directly related to that. And the other thing that he talks about was the keep calm and carry on.
Yeah.
So you've seen that. I've seen that.
Yes, but yeah.
I did a little research on this, and what I found is not what I expected to read at all. So here we go. Keep calm and carry on was one of several different types of posters or themes, slogans that were used by the British prior to the World War II to build up a World War II and during World War II as propaganda to basically convey to their citizenry, hey, bad stuff's going to happen, but keep calm and carry on. The other ones that they used was your courage and freedom is in peril. They had a bunch of these, right? It sounds very, very British. So I thought, well, these must have just been pasted everywhere. And it became part of British society, military tradition. Here's what really happened. In 1939, over a one-month period, 2.45 million of these posters that read, "Keep calm and carry on," were printed. The idea was, they were going to keep these in cold storage and then use these, post these around the cities after a serious air raid. But for whatever reason, some of the other slogans, like the one I just mentioned, "Your courage and freedom is in peril," were seen as more popular. So In 1940, less than a year after these 2.45 million posters were made, they were all pulped and recycled and sent to create paper for other things. And it wasn't until 2000, at some sort of antique roadshow in London, there was some cache of these, some small number of these posters that were found in old books and apartments, and it just took off. The British people loved it. It turns out that this idea that this poster was part of, like, British culture and lore.
The Blitz.
The Blitz. It's not true. It wasn't used at all. Some remnants were found much later, and it didn't become popularized until the year 2000. In fact, a bunch of businessmen decided to jump on it, and they wanted to, like, trademark the name and do a bunch of stuff with it. And the British courts decided, no, it's too open. It's too ambiguous. We're not going to let you do that. It's open to the public. And I don't know about you, but I see the keep calm and carry on things all over the place, associated with websites. And apparently, the modern day British military, according to Steve.
What's interesting is, like, that they got rid of that during apparently around the height of the Blitz.
Yes.
You know, and if they're getting bombed by the Germans during the Blitz, I would rather see that slogan out there, I would think, than this, which is, your courage is in peril.
Right.
That's an opposite connotation for me. I think, well, wait a second. Why we just got bombed and you're saying my courage is in peril? Are you calling me a coward?
I mean, I don't know. I mean,
I don't understand.
Keep calm and carry. Look, in 2000, it was so cool. People jumped all over it. It would have been just as freaking amazing back in 1939 and 40.
Yeah.
You know, the Brits are famous for being able to name things and tag things. I think they failed on this one. I think this is something what I expected, Ryan, was I thought, hey, they published these during the Blitz. The military adopted it. And it became just part of their mantra going forward. But no, that's not how it went down at all.
What's the keep calm and chive on?
So that's when the website picked that up. And that's from the Chive website. And that's a website that basically has a series of pictures that people post, usually females, that are not safe for work.
Oh, okay.
So I've been told.
Well, you know, the British have this culture with their tabloids where, you know, you walk around London and you'll see, you know, they're not as shy with female appendages and like we are over here, and they'll just have them on the front page there at the newsstand, you know.
Yes.
And
hey, here's Princess Di's boobs at the beach. And I'm not even kidding. It's like, if you're famous and you're at a nude beach in Europe, your stuff's going to be on some tabloid there. And you're right. United States, that would never fly.
No.
Oh, gosh. All right. So that's the keep calm, carry on. So now the next clip, maybe a couple clips. We'll see how this goes. He speaks to more about the day-to-day stuff, about them transitioning, about them getting used to being on the base and starting to do their job.
We have covered a lot of ground here so far, Tony. Very meaningful, highbrow ground.
Yeah, like not safe for work websites, wooden boxes that were given you in college that your wife's trying to destroy. We got all kinds of stuff here.
We sure do. And we got a lot more coming your way next week as we dive into Steve's time in the theater. So up until now, in the first two episodes, you've gotten to know Steve a little bit about the training, about the mission, and now we're going to transition into his time in theater in Iraq with Aziz. So join us next week. You're not going to want to miss it. All right, listener feedback time. One of my favorite parts of the show. I mean, the first part, obviously, is being able to do the research and share these clips with these interviews with our audience, but you know, it's nice to know that people are listening to this, and we want to share some of the feedback that we've received. And so this one was from some feedback that we got from the Apple podcast site, where our podcast can be listened to. And it's not just there. Pretty much any site that hosts podcasts, the Warrior Next Door is available. And if you don't feel comfortable in that space, you can go to our website, thewarriornextdoor.com. And you can click on any of the
interviews that we have featured, the people we've interviewed, and they each have their own web page with links that you can click and listen to the podcast for free right from the website. But at any rate, here is a review we received very recently, whose username is Who Are You? Who? They don't have the who part. But at any rate, they're obviously the Who fans, and so am I, and it's great. And what they wrote was this. Having studied World War II, World War I, and the American Civil War for most of my 60 years on this earth, this podcast, coupled with Ray Harris's History of World War II podcast, has taught me and entertained me more than I could have imagined. Thanks for being serious about your subjects without losing your sense of humor, especially the self-deprecating humor and the teasing of each other. It is all of pure enjoyment for me. Signed off, Lynn. Yeah, you can tell Ryan and I have been friends for a very, very long time. We're best friends. We share a lot of passions for a wide variety of things, and this is one of them. And it's a real pleasure to be able to read feedback from people who can pick up on that, because it's not something we try to do. It's just who we are. We've said in the past that this podcast isn't supported by large groups of people or iHeartRadio. It's just Ryan and I who have a passion for this. We want to share it with others, and we cannot appreciate, you'll never know how much we appreciate getting feedback like this from others. And also the ones that are critical. So if there's something that we could do better, share that feedback as well. And we take that into account too. So until next week.